We have arrived now at the 11th chapter of Genesis, where we're introduced into the next section of the book, which centers upon the life of Abraham. A number of years ago, I concluded a series of studies on the life of Abraham that will pick up right at this point, therefore, and if any of you are interested in going on in Genesis, you can refer to that series. Now in chapter 11, we're dealing with the last phase of our series on understanding society. And what we have discovered here is the only realistic explanation that I know of anywhere in the world today for the straining forces that twist and heave and pull at the plastic mass of society as we know it in our day. And if we hope to understand life and how to handle it properly, we must therefore understand what's going on in our human society and understand these issues that are presented here. We shall, in the passage that we look at this morning on the Tower of Babel, find the answer to one of the great mysteries of life, of our day and all days, the mystery of a race which hungers after unity, which is forever seeking to be one, but is also forever ending up splitting itself into fragments and dividing into splinters and schisms and cliques. Why should this be so? Well, we shall grasp that, I hope, as we look at this passage together. And we begin, you'll note, in the days when the race was yet one undivided entity, in chapter 11, verses 1 through 4. Now the whole earth had one language and few words. And as men migrated in the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." When this account says that the earth had one language and few words, what it literally is saying is it had one language and one set of words. It's not few words, as we have here, but one set of words. Few words suggests a lady in our congregation who frequently says, "I'm a woman of few words, but I use them frequently." But this is not what is meant here. This is one set of words. That is one speech, as the Authorized Version, I think, puts it. And it is this that is the noteworthy feature of humanity of that day. They were still one undivided people. You remember that in the last chapter, chapter 10, the whole essence of that chapter is one of movement, migration. People are thrusting out from a center, like spokes of a wheel, radiating out into the corners of the earth. And this chapter opens on the same note. As men moved about, they came into the plain of Shinar. An alluvial plain lying between the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And this name, Shinar, indicates to us that these people were Hamites. These were the descendants of Ham, because in chapter 10 we were told it was the Hamites who settled in the land of Shinar, or Babylonia, or Mesopotamia, as we know it today. So that it was a branch of the Hamitic family that came, migrated into the Tigris-Euphrates river valleys and found a level plain there upon which they settled. And immediately the inventiveness of the Hamitic people becomes evident. Remember, these were the technicians of humanity, the technologically gifted people. And that inventiveness becomes evident in the way they found means of adapting to the situation in which they live. This is always characteristic of Hamitic people wherever they've gone. They They did not find rocks and stones such as they had found in the land where they lived to build with, and so they made bricks out of dirt, out of clay, and later discovered the process of burning them, first in the sun and then in the furnace, until they became hard and impermeable, bricks such as we know them today. Now, all this is given to us in one sentence in the Bible, but we know from history that it occupied a period of time. Man didn't all discover this all at once, but he learned how to make bricks and to burn them eventually in the sun. And then they lacked lime for cement, and so they couldn't make mortar as we know it. But they discovered, some inventive Yankee among them, discovered a tar pit, which was filled with natural asphalt. And these are very familiar occurrences throughout the Middle East. And they discovered that the tar would stick. And so they used this natural bitumen, this asphalt, for mortar. And they had then a substitute for stones and cement. They made bricks and they used asphalt for mortar. And thus they demonstrated how adaptable they were to the situations that they found. Now, their success in doing these things fired their ambition. This always happens with human beings. When they discovered that they could use other material than the natural material for building and invent their own, they were fired with the desire to put this to work. And they began to talk excitedly about building a city and a tower. Now, these two things that they mentioned are very significant and very revealing. We saw the appearance of the first city back in the story of Cain and Abel, when Cain went out and built a city. And it illustrated the hunger of humanity to huddle together into city life, even though they weren't ready to do this, as they still obviously are not ready to live together in cities. Though God's intention is to build a city for man. Abraham looked for a city whose builder and maker is God, city with foundation. But man wasn't ready for that. But here they are, ready to build a city to satisfy, obviously, the desires of the body and of the soul. There's nothing that does it better than human beings living together in a city. Cities are the center of commercial and business life, where all the needs of the body can be best met. And cities are also the center of pleasure and culture, where all the hungers of the soul can be satisfied, for beauty and art and music and all the other ingredients of culture. The tower, on the other hand, is designed, obviously, to satisfy the needs of the spirit of man. And here you see, reflected in these two things, the fundamental understanding of the nature of man as body, soul, and spirit, all to be satisfied in these two elementary needs, the city and the tower. A number of years ago, archaeologists digging in the plain of Shinar discovered the remains of great towers that these early Babylonians had built. And some archaeologists have felt that they may even have found the actual foundations of this original Tower of Babel. That's hard to determine. But they did find that the Babylonians built these great towers called ziggurats, which are built in a spiral fashion, with an ascending staircase in a spiral way that terminates at the top in a circular balcony or a circular top around which are written the signs of the zodiac. And obviously it was a religious building intended to expose man to the mystery of the heavens and the greatness of God. And that perhaps is what is meant here by this statement, that they intended to build a tower with its top in the heavens. I think they were impressed by its greatness architecturally. That is, it was a colossal thing for the men of that day to build. But, and they may have thought of it as reaching into heaven. But they also unquestionably were thinking of it as a means of communication with God. and of maintaining contact with Him. God is not to be left out, you see, in the city of man, but He's there, represented by this tower. Now, the heart of the matter, however, is laid bare to us in these words, "Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." Already a haunting fear had set in upon the race. They were conscious already of a disruptive influence in their midst, of a centrifugal force that was pushing them apart. They couldn't live together too closely. And which would ultimately, they feared, scatter them abroad and leave them unknown, unhonored, unsung, and living in isolated communities where they would be exposed to danger. And the fear of this caused them to want to build a tower and a city. And the ultimate end is expressed in these words, "Let us make a name for ourselves." Now that's, from that day on, been the motto of humanity. Let's make a name for ourselves. I'm always amused when I travel through cities to see how many public edifices have a plaque somewhere in which it is all the names of the public officials that were in power when that city or edifice was built are inscribed. The mayor of the city, the head of the public works department, and so on. And here in California, you can still find buildings marked that date from the days of Governor Warren, Governor Brown, and others, because their names are inscribed on them. Let's make a name for ourselves is a fundamental urge in a fallen race. And it reveals here one of the basic drives of humanism. Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things. That's the philosophy of humanism. Glory to mankind. And the fact that this tower was a religious tower, and yet built to make a name for man, reveals a master motive behind mere religion. It's a means by which man attempts to share the glory of God. Now, we must understand this. Otherwise, we'll never understand the drive behind religion as it has pervaded the earth and permeated our culture ever since. It's a way by which man seeks to share the glory of God. This was a grandiose structure, this tower, and undoubtedly, it was said that it was to be a means by which man would glorify God. Unquestionably, there was a plaque somewhere attached to it that said, erected in the day of such and such a year to the greater glory of God. But it wasn't really for the glory of God. It was a way of controlling God, a way of channeling God and using Him for man's glory. That's what religion has always sought to do. A way of somehow making God available to us. You see, man doesn't want to eliminate God. It's only sporadically, and then only for a relatively brief time, that men cry out for the elimination of God. But atheism is too barren and too pessimistic and too morally bankrupt to live with very long. The communists are finding this out. No, we need dear old God. But let's keep Him under control. Let's not let Him get out of His place. Don't call us God, we'll call you. This is the fundamental philosophy of society. Now, in the next section here, you get the reaction of God to all this. And it's a section, pardon me, of exquisite irony. We read in verse 5 and 6, "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which they'd built. Now, I know that in certain circles that's regarded as a primitive expression of a primitive concept of God, that God lives up in heaven somewhere, and he's cut off from direct communication with earth, and he's dependent upon certain messenger boys who travel back and forth that keep him informed. And somehow God, some message had reached God, and he decided to come down and investigate. But this is not a primitive concept of God. It's impossible to read it that way if you read it in the light of what you've already read in the book of Genesis. In this book already, God has been presented as the maker of heaven and earth, the one involved with the minutest details of creation, the omnipotent, omniscient God who knows everything and sees everything and is all-powerful. No, you see, it's not a primitive concept of God at all. It's an ironic expression. It's a humorous expression, if you please, designed to indicate to us in a very clever way the ridiculousness of this whole situation. Here is this tower that men erect, thinking it's going to take God's breath away, that it threatens him. Here we are, we wild Promethean creatures. We've dared to invade the heavens. You better watch out, God. But up in the real heavens, this tower is so little, God can't even see it. It's so tiny that even the strongest telescope in heaven does not reveal it. And so God says, I'll come down and investigate. It's language, you see, designed to set in contrast the ridiculousness of the suppositions of men and the greatness and the being of God. He came down to investigate this tiny little tower that men have erected. And then in all seriousness, we're given the divine analysis of this situation. And there are three things that God took note of in this. First, man's unity. The Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And he took note of that fact. Second, he noted their creativity. This is only the beginning, he says, of what they will do. This is part of the image of God, which he conferred upon man. This inventiveness, this creativity, this ability to think and reason and to deal in concepts and put them together and come out with a very practical application. And the nature of it is suggested here. You notice God doesn't suggest that man does everything at once. He builds gradually. One man discovers an idea and another one improves it. A third one yet links it with another idea. And so gradually there takes form inventive solutions to the technical problems of life. And God took note of that fact, that man is an inventive creature, and he's a united creature. And as a result of these two factors at work in society, God comes to this startling conclusion. There is nothing, this is only the beginning, nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible to them. Now that sounds rather up to date, doesn't it? That's exactly what man has thought about himself all along, and what he's saying in a thousand ways today, loudly announcing to himself continually. There's nothing we can't solve, nothing we can't do. And the startling thing from the scripture is that there's truth in that. God himself acknowledges it. He says this is true. That if man puts his genius to any given specific task, his native creativeness and his persistent spirit will solve that problem eventually. And he will come up with a solution to what he proposes to do. Nothing will be prevented him. Now look at God's action. Verse 7. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. That's startling, isn't it? Here these people had built this tower and this city in order that they not be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. But the net result is that because they built the tower in the city, they were scattered abroad throughout the face of all the earth. That's where they ended up, doing the very thing that they feared. Now, why does God do this? What's behind his actions here? Is he jealous of man? Is God threatened by, after all, by this mud and slime tower that these men have built? Does it mean that he is afraid that man is going to master things that he cannot any longer control? And that the very foundations of the universe will be threatened by this inventive facility in man? No, that's the way man wants to read this. And forever we've been telling ourselves that we can do anything we want if we want it bad enough. And therefore we don't need God. And God, therefore, is threatened in human life. We're ready to dismiss him, or at least to remove him to a quiet corner of the house where he won't bother anybody, except when we need him once in a while to run some special errands. And it's true, as we've already seen, that God admits that man can do these things if he puts his mind to them. He can do anything. But what about be? That's the question. You see, there's a fatal flaw in man's thinking. What does he actually purpose or propose to do? And the final answer is to glorify himself, to be the center of things, to be the master of the universe, to be God, in other words. And God knows that man is incapable of this. He's a creature. He is a dependent being. He always was and he always will be. The very forces that he thinks he can manipulate to the end of accomplishing his aim are forces that are part and parcel of his own life, which he did not make and upon which he depends. And that therefore he is incapable, constitutionally incapable, of being the God he attempts to be. You see, it's always the old story, isn't it, of the sorcerer's apprentice. You remember the story in mythology of the boy who hired himself out to the sorcerer to haul his water, to carry his water in for him. And like all boys, tiring of the work, he looked around to find some other way of getting the job done. One day when the master was away, he prowled around among his magical paraphernalia and apparatus, and he found some books with some incantations, magic words in them. And he learned a few of them, and he tried them out on the broom. And to his amazement, he found that he was able to command the broom to carry the water in buckets. And he found an easy way to get his job done. And he sat back and opened a magazine and read to himself while the broom carried in the water, bucket after bucket. But after a bit, he detected a bit of moisture on the floor. And to his consternation, he realized that the tubs and the basins were all full and the broom was still carrying in the water. And he decided he'd better do something about it. You remember, he rose and uttered the same incantation, and the broom just kept on carrying in the water, dumping it on the floor. And as it began to rise around his ankles, the boy panicked. He didn't know what to do. And he cried out every magic word he could think of, but nothing worked. And the broom kept on carrying in the buckets and dumping them on the floor. And as the water rose around his neck, he began to cry out in anguish and realized that he hadn't learned enough yet. And he was saved just at the last moment by the return of the master, who in a few words cleared up the whole situation. That's a parable, you see, of the Tower of Babel. Man in his inventiveness who thinks he can master the earth, but the very things that solutions he works out become the bigger problems which he can no longer encompass. And the whole scheme of things eludes him. He's not able to put them together. And so for man's sake, you see this? This is the heart of this. For man's sake, not because God is afraid of man, but for man's sake, to protect him from himself, God said, let us go down and confuse their language. Let's stop this man in his mad folly from destroying himself off the face of the earth because he isn't enough to handle it. And so he came down, and suddenly as the workers gathered for work one morning, they found they couldn't communicate with each other anymore. What a scene this must have been. The foreman would give the orders, and the men would shake their heads. Didn't understand it. And the foreman would yell back. They wouldn't get it. And they'd try to explain, and he couldn't understand them. And you can imagine what fist shaking and table pounding and yelling and so on went on here. It was utter confusion. And the Bible plays upon the name for Babel here, and links it with the Hebrew word for confusion, balal. And it says that this was indeed a veritable balal of confusion. Now, it's interesting that the name Babel means the gate of God. That's what man named the tower. But in the ultimate outcome of this, it became the place of confusion. The gate of God, in man's eyes, becomes confusion in the eyes of God. And since that very day, men have been divided by this division of tongues. Now, it's most striking here that this confusion of tongues is most evident even yet today in the Hamitic families of earth. Linguists know that most of the families of earth languages can be gathered into family groups. There's the Indo-European family of languages and others. And the Japhetic line and the Semitic line are really very closely allied. It's not difficult to group those tongues. But in the Hamitic families, all is utter confusion. Tribes of people growing up closely by one another have completely different languages. And that still persists even to this day. And it still divides mankind. We're all aware of how we must overcome this with the most awkward devices of translation. The United Nations cannot even meet together without mechanical gadgets of translation by which they can understand one another. And we think we solve this by translating one language to another. But any linguist knows that language is much deeper than words, that it is a basic fundamental element reflecting the thought life and the culture pattern of people, and that if you don't know a man, that merely knowing the words of a man's language by no means guarantees that you know the man. You must know much more about it than that. And this loss of language here, this confusion of language, represents a loss of basic understanding between people. The loss of the ability to communicate at the deepest levels of thought. I was struck by a quotation taken from a world traveler recently who said this: on my trip to Asia, the word Coca-Cola was the one word I understood in every language. It sprang out familiarly from signs written in the most alien characters. What's wrong with a world in which this is the only word that has survived the Babylonian confusion of tongues? We can still talk to one another about Coca-Cola, but not about freedom, not about God, not about what a neighbor is. Isn't that striking? And the impressive thing to me is that man today is still haunted by the need of unity. He feels the lack of this. He feels if we can just get together with our technological abilities, if we can just cooperate, we can do anything. Isn't that the dream that still hangs over humanity? If we can merge, and this is the day of the merger, corporations merging, nations merging, companies merging, churches merging, if we can just get one great community again, with our technological excellence, we can master the earth. The dream still hangs over us. But God still scatters. God still continues the confusion of tongues. This may go hard with a Wycliffe translator who's seeking to impart the scripture in the various languages of earth, and it requires great labor and work to do so. But nevertheless, it's the kindness of God that scatters the speech of man. It's God's way of preventing the ultimate catastrophe. For when man at last gets together again, and under the illusion of technical ability, thinks he can master all the great and intricate, complex mechanism of life in the universe and in the world, we will have discovered the ultimate disaster. And this is why God continues to humble men everywhere, and scatters, and humiliates, and brings low the proud. Why? Because as Jesus said in the opening words of the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor in spirit, the man who has nothing, the man who has lost everything upon which he can depend outside and inside himself, for his is the kingdom of heaven. When you no longer depend on anything in you, then God is ready to give you everything that he possesses. And that's the basic element and message of the Christian faith. Our Father, oh, the depths of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. Who has been thy counselor, Lord? Which of men has instructed thee? How we need to quietly listen and remember that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That without your mind, we will only make a continual mess of things, both individually and as a race. Teach us this, Lord, above all else. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.